Welcome to the Employment Law and HR Podcast with your host, Allison Cauley.
Hello and welcome to episode number 45 of the Employment Law and HR Podcast. I'm your host, Allison Cauley. I'm an employment solicitor and HR specialist at Real Employment Law Advice, which is a niche employment law practice. This week's episode of the podcast is actually part 6 and the final part of the mini-series on redundancy. For those of you who've been listening over the last 5 weeks, you'll know that I've been covering everything to do with redundancy in this 6-part series. And today is just a roundup dealing with some unusual circumstances that might arise and some frequently asked questions. So just to wrap up some of those unusual scenarios that arise. So without further ado, I'm going to get straight into this week's content. Now, what I'm going to talk about in this episode are a couple of scenarios that arise in relation to redundancy quite frequently and which aren't necessarily covered by the sort of straightforward consultation rules and processes. And a couple of them I might have touched upon in previous episodes and mentioned that I would be dealing with them today. I'm also going to cover a couple of frequently asked questions about redundancy. If you have any questions that aren't covered by this episode, then do please get in touch. You can contact me. It's alison@realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk. So first up, what I'm going to talk to you about is maternity. Now, how do you deal with redundancy for somebody who is on maternity leave? Well, if you've got an employee who's on maternity leave and they form part of the pool for redundancy, so if their role falls into the pool for redundancy, then you have an obligation to consult with them in the same way as you do with other employees. Now, what I would say about an employee on maternity leave, clearly they're going to have other priorities in their life. If they've just had a baby, they're going to have commitments at home. So you need to be a bit more flexible with your process is the advice I would give you. And you need to ensure that you try to engage them, you keep them informed from the very outset, and that they are aware of what's going on in the same way as other employees. Now, this could involve having meetings around them, having them at different times than you would with other employees, for instance. And it could even mean going to see the employee at home. If they've just got a newborn and they're having difficulty with childcare, it could be going to see them at home to make it easier for them or inviting them to bring the baby in with them. But you do have an obligation to consult with them. So you can't just write them a letter and say, this is what's happening, and because they're on maternity leave, sort of ignore them. You have to involve them in the process. Now, if you dismiss an employee during their maternity leave for redundancy, then their statutory maternity pay will continue. If they qualify for maternity pay and you make them redundant, so they're selected for redundancy, then if they've got any remaining statutory maternity pay period, that continues even though their employment has ended. With regards to redundancy pay for an employee on maternity leave, you're required to calculate it in accordance with their normal week's pay. So that's the week's pay they would have received if they'd been at work, rather than working it out based on their statutory maternity pay. You must ensure that an employee on maternity leave does not lose out in any way in terms of redundancy pay because of their maternity leave. So they shouldn't be treated any differently to anybody else. And maybe the biggest difference with an employee on maternity leave compared to those who aren't is that you're required to offer any suitable alternative vacancies to an employee on maternity leave as a priority over anybody else. Now, I touched upon this in part 4, which was episode 43 of the podcast, when I talked about alternative vacancies and redundancy. But just to recap and to remind you, if you have a suitable alternative vacancy, so that's a vacancy which is both suitable and appropriate in all the circumstances. So it must be appropriate in terms of the role and the capacity and the place, and other terms and conditions mustn't be substantially different. So if you have a particular alternative role that fits that criteria, then you are required to offer that to the person on maternity leave if they've been selected for redundancy over and above anybody else. So it's one form of positive discrimination. It's not very often that there are situations where you have to have positive discrimination, but for an employee on maternity leave, there is. If you fail to offer them that suitable alternative vacancy, then it would be automatically unfair dismissal and you could find yourself having to pay compensation out to the employee in those circumstances. And another interesting point to note on this is that you are not allowed to require the employee to undergo a competitive interview for the role. So an employee on maternity leave literally has to be offered the job as a priority without having to go through any assessment criteria. And if they accept the job, then their new role takes over at the time that their old contract ends. So at the end of the redundancy period, their new contract starts immediately thereafter, even though they're on maternity leave. Now, what I should say is, as I mentioned earlier, it does have to be a suitable a vacancy, and there's no obligation to offer a role as a priority if it's not suitable and appropriate. And there was a case on this, which was Simpson versus Ensley Insurance Services, in which an employee worked in London and there were vacancies in Cheltenham. The Employment Appeal Tribunal in that case decided that it wasn't a suitable vacancy because it was so far away from the original location where the employee was employed, and so there was no obligation to make that offer as a priority. So in a redundancy scenario where you've got let's just say a factory which is being wholesale moved, let's say from the south coast up to Scotland. In those circumstances, even though the role would be suitable because it would be exactly the same, there would be no obligation upon you to make an offer of employment to an employee on maternity leave for the new role in Scotland. You could obviously offer it to them anyway if you wanted to, and you wouldn't be penalised if you didn't offer it to them as a priority. Now, one question that I'm often asked about this situation is that, well, we're making redundancies or we're restructuring or whatever. We're changing the business. We're making big changes here. We need things to be working efficiently and really well once the redundancy process is concluded. And we need all the right people in those roles immediately. How do we deal with that then if we've got to offer an employee on maternity leave? Let's just say an employee who's got another 10 months left of their maternity leave, we've got to offer them a new role. We're then going to be in a scenario where we're having to fill that with a temporary person and that just doesn't work for the business. I do sympathise with you there, but unfortunately, if you don't, it can be rather costly. So I guess you've got to weigh up the commercial decision. And of course, in every scenario, the employee on maternity leave may not want to accept the new role. And if they don't accept it and you've done your obligation by offering it to them, then you're free to fill it as a competitive process or however you want to do so in selecting persons for the new role. One final point to note here is in relation to notice. If an employee is made redundant whilst they're on maternity leave, they're still entitled to notice. And in terms of notice pay, I would recommend that you get advice about the amount of notice pay that you have to pay an employee in a particular scenario if they're on maternity leave, because it may be that you have to pay them their full rate of pay during notice rather than their statutory maternity pay or whatever they're getting whilst they're on maternity leave. It's certainly worth getting advice if you have employees on maternity leave when you're making redundancies. Okay, next up is in relation to employees who are off sick. Now, it's a similar scenario, I suppose, to those who are on maternity leave in terms of how you consult and engage with them in the process. Obviously, you have to take into consideration their particular reason for being off sick, and you need to try to engage with them. Now, again, this may be making adjustments to your process by perhaps having individual meetings with them and going to see them at home, perhaps, or having them at alternative times. Now, if you have an employee who has, for instance, had a breakdown or has severe mental health issues, I would suggest, and you should already be doing this anyway, but I would suggest that you obtain an occupational health report or a report from their GP as to whether they are fit to engage in any such process with you and any adjustments that can be made. That's just it's ensuring that you're doing the right thing for your employee, but it's also covering you to make sure you're not putting unnecessary pressure on somebody who's already particularly vulnerable. Now, if you have an employee who's on sick leave and they refuse to engage in the process with you at all, and this can happen, employees often will put up barriers and say, well, I'm off sick, so I can't talk to you. Now, if you've tried to engage with them and they're just not having any of it and they're aware of what the situation is, then you may be able to proceed without having their involvement. Now, if you've got a redundancy situation where you just have one employee, for instance, or two employees, because one of them is the employee who's off sick, then I would suggest that you take additional steps to try to get them to be involved in the process and perhaps consider putting things off slightly to enable them to recover. It's more likely that an employment tribunal will find a dismissal to be unfair for failure to consult and engage with the process if and it's a scenario where it's just one or two employees. Where you have a larger scale redundancy and there are a number of employees involved, the employment tribunal are more likely to be sympathetic if you don't delay in the process and you've tried everything you can to get them to engage. So again, what I would suggest with sick employees, if you are going through a redundancy process, you need to just get some specific advice about that scenario. In terms of what you pay an employee who's on sick leave for redundancy, if they're selected, well, if they have normal pay and normal hours, so they always get the same, really, then you just work out what their normal pay is or the average of the last 12 weeks of their working time, so before they went on sick leave. Where an employee has no normal hours and no normal pay, this can be slightly different because what the rules say are that you should calculate the last 12 weeks remuneration. Now that could include the statutory sick pay as remuneration. So there is an argument potentially to say where an employee has no normal working hours and no normal pay, that you could calculate their redundancy pay based on the last 12 weeks, even if that includes statutory sick pay. Again, what I would suggest you do is you take each scenario separately, and if you have a situation where you're making an employee redundant who's on sick leave and who is currently receiving statutory sick pay or has exhausted their entitlement to sick pay and they have no normal working hours and no normal pay, then you should get some advice about what you do in that situation. Again, you might decide that you take a view on it from a commercial perspective, that you just pay them at a standard rate for redundancy rather than just through the SSP, because it could be much more hassle to do so otherwise. It all depends on how much we're talking about here, I suppose, but it's definitely worth getting some advice. Next up, I just want to mention to you about the ACAS Code of Practice, and this was mentioned in relation to the process, which I dealt with in parts 2 and 3 of the redundancy mini-series. And that's to say that the ACAS Code of Practice, which deals with dismissals for disciplinary and capability reasons, does not apply to redundancy dismissals. And so there is a different test in terms of the process required between a disciplinary dismissal and a redundancy dismissal. And you should be aware of that. There is still a requirement to follow a fair procedure, but you don't have to follow what's contained within the ACAS Code of Practice on dismissals. In terms of an employee's right to be accompanied, in situations where there is a disciplinary dismissal, for instance, then an employee has a right to be accompanied. But with regards to redundancy, there's no right for an employee to be accompanied at redundancy meetings. Now, what I would say here is that it is good practice to allow employees to be accompanied at those meetings. They can be stressful. It can take away some of the stress and anxiety for the employees, but it could also make it much easier for you in terms of trying to explain the process and to get employees to engage with you. So whilst there's no legal obligation to, there might be an obligation in your employment contracts or your staff handbooks to allow them to be accompanied as well. But what I would say is, if an employee asks to be accompanied at that meeting, then you should consider that practically and the impact it will have. My view on the right to be accompanied at meetings is that you should just use a common sense approach, really. And what harm is there to have an employee be accompanied by a work colleague or a friend or relative if they're finding it particularly hard to deal with? And then my final frequently asked question is, do you have to involve voluntary redundancy candidates in the consultation process? Now, when you start a redundancy, one of the things to do would be to ask for anybody who would like to take voluntary redundancy. And in some cases, you might find that there are people that are willing to take voluntary redundancy and they come forward. Now, the question is, do you have to involve them in the consultation process? Well, my advice on this is that you should take a cautionary approach, and I would, include them within the consultation process. It's good practice to do so. So that is to invite them to those meetings and deal with it that way. The alternative would be to offer them a settlement agreement. So you would say to them, well, if you're going to take voluntary redundancy, then I'd like you to sign a settlement agreement to confirm that you're waiving your rights in terms of the redundancy process and unfair dismissal, those sorts of things. That way you're covering your back in case they change their mind later on, or they say that they've been put under undue pressure in order to take voluntary redundancy. And of course, what you should be aware of in terms of the requirements for collective consultation, which is a legal requirement where you're making 20 or more employees redundant. And I dealt with that in part two of this mini series. So for the purposes of calculating the numbers of employees for redundancy to see whether it tips into collective consultation, you must include those employees who are taking voluntary redundancy. Okay, so there are a few particular scenarios and questions that arise, which I haven't yet covered in the previous five parts of this six-part mini-series. Hopefully that's answered many of your questions and that you found the redundancy mini-series helpful in guiding you through redundancy processes. If you would like some specific advice about your particular scenario, or you would like somebody to either deal with the process for you or to hold your hand through the process, then that's the kind of service that I offer at Real Employment Law Advice. I'd be very happy to help you, and I can provide you with a fixed fee rate, or I can provide you with my normal hourly service, depending on the work that's required. So do please get in touch. It's alison@realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk. You can find more information about redundancy and some other frequently asked questions on my website, which is adviceforemployers.co.uk. There are regular updates on there, and if you just use the search criteria for redundancy, you'll find all the information that's been provided about redundancy. I look forward to talking to you more in 2016, and the next episode of the podcast will be back on Monday, the 11th of January. I'm taking a little bit of time off over the New Year period to regroup and plan for 2016. So I'll be back on Monday, the 11th of January, with an episode giving you a rundown on what to expect in employment law for 2016. If you are based on the South Coast and you would like more information about what's happening in 2016, and you'd like to attend an update event to ensure that you're on top of the best practice for HR in 2016, then you can find more details at adviceforemployers.co.uk/events. The event's taking place on Thursday, the 14th of January, and you can book online at adviceforemployers.co.uk/events. Many thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very happy new year and a prosperous 2016. Thanks again for listening. Just want to finalise by saying I wouldn't be a lawyer unless I had a legal disclaimer. So I must just say to you that the information in this podcast is for information only. It's general review and a general update. It's always necessary to get specific legal advice about your circumstances. So please don't rely on anything that you've heard in this podcast. But please do feel free to contact me if you'd like further information or specific advice.